I pretended I knew all about that through my underworld contacts. I told Irene I had it on good authority that the corpse had been a member of the Sabini gang. "I really was a fool," said Gloria quietly. "A little idiot. But I always had the feeling Margot could see right through me. She told me not long after I started there that she'd seen something in me at the interview. I didn't like that. I felt as though she was patronizing me. She never treated me the way I wanted to be treated, as some street-smart mafia girl with dark secrets, but always as though I was just a sweet young girl. Irene didn't like Margot either, and we used to moan about her all the time on reception. Margot had a big thing about education and keeping your career, and we used to say what a hypocrite she was, because she'd married this rich consultant. When you're living a lie, nothing's more threatening than people who tell the truth. I'm sorry, said Gloria, with an impatient shake of the head. This probably doesn't seem relevant at all, but it is, if you just bear with me.
Take your time, said Strike.
Well, the day after my 18th birthday, Luca and I got into a row. I can't remember what it was about, but he put his hand round my throat and pushed me up against the wall until I couldn't breathe. I was terrified. He let go, but there was this horrible look in his eye. He said, "You've only got yourself to blame." And he said, "You're starting to sound like that doctor." I talked to him quite a lot about Margot, you see. I told him she was a complete killjoy, really bossy and opinionated. I kept repeating things she'd said, to denigrate them, to tell myself there was nothing in them. She quoted Simone de Beauvoir once, during a staff meeting. She'd sworn when she dropped her pen, and Dr. Brenner said, "People are always asking me what it's like working with a lady doctor, and if I ever meet one, I'll be able to tell them." Dorothy laughed. She hardly ever laughed. And Margot snapped right back at him. "I know the quotation off by heart now, in French, too. Man is defined as a human being, and a woman as a female. Whenever she behaves as a human being, she is said to imitate the male." Irene and I talked about it afterwards. We called her a show-off for quoting some French woman, but things like that got in my head, and I couldn't get them out again. I thought I wanted to be a 50s mafia housewife. But sometimes Margot was really funny, and I watched her never backing down to Brenner, and you couldn't help admiring her for it. Gloria took yet another gulp of wine. Anyway, the evening Luca half-throttled me, I went home and lay awake, crying half the night. The next morning, I put on a polo neck for work to hide the bruises. And at 5 o'clock that afternoon, when I left work, I went straight to a call box near the surgery, rang Luca, and finished with him. I told him he'd scared me and that I didn't want to see him any more. He took it quite quietly. I was surprised, but so relieved. For 3 or 4 days I thought it was all over, and I felt amazing. It was like waking up or coming up for air after being underwater. I still wanted to be a mobster's girlfriend, but the fantasy version was fine. I'd had a little bit too much contact with reality. Then, at the end of our practice Christmas party, in walked Luca with his father and one of his cousins. I was absolutely terrified to see them there. Luca said to me, "Dad just wanted to meet my girlfriend." And, I don't know why, except I was petrified of there being a scene, I just said, "Oh, okay." And I grabbed my coat and left with the three of them, before anyone could talk to them. They walked me to my bus stop. On the way, Nico said, "You're a nice girl. Luca was very upset by what you said to him on the phone. He's very fond of you, you know. You don't want to make him unhappy, do you?" Then he and Luca's cousin walked away. Luca said, "You didn't mean what you said, did you?" And I was so scared. Him bringing his father and cousin along. I told myself I'd be able to get out of it later. Just keep him happy for now. So I said, "No, I didn't mean it. You won't do anything like that ever again, though, will you?" And he said, "Like what?" As if he'd never pressed on my windpipe till I couldn't breathe. As though I'd imagined it. "So we carried on seeing each other," said Gloria. Luca started talking about getting married. I kept saying I felt too young. Every time I came close to ending it, he'd accuse me of cheating on him, which was the worst crime of all, and there was no way of proving I wasn't, except to keep going out with him. Now Gloria looked away from them, her eyes on something off-screen. We were sleeping together by then. I didn't want to. I'm not saying he forced me. Not really, said Gloria. And Robin thought of Shifty's PA, Gemma. But keeping him happy was the only way to keep going. Otherwise there'd be a slap, or worse. One time he made some comment about hurting my grandmother if I didn't behave. I went crazy at him and he laughed, and said it was an obvious joke, but he wanted to plant the idea in my mind. And he succeeded. And he didn't believe in contraception. We were supposed to be using the, you know, the rhythm method, said Gloria, reaching again for her wine. But he was, let's say he was careless, and I was sure he wanted me pregnant, because then he'd have me cornered, and I'd marry him. My grandparents would probably have backed him up. They were devout people. So, without telling Luca, I went to Margot for the pill. She said she was happy to give it to me, but she didn't know I had a boyfriend even. I'd never said. And even though I didn't really like her, said Gloria, I told her some of it. It was the only place I could drop the pretense, I suppose. I knew she couldn't tell anyone outside her consulting room. She tried to talk sense into me, tried to show me there were ways out of the situation, apart from just giving in to Luca all the time. I thought it was all right for her, with all her money and her big safe house. But she gave me a bit of hope, I suppose. Once, after he'd hit me and told me I'd asked for it, and told me I should be grateful I had someone offering me a way out of living at home with two old people, I said, there are other places I could go. And I think he got worried someone had offered to help me get away. I'd stopped making fun of Margot by this time, and Luca wasn't a stupid man. That's when he wrote her threatening notes. Anonymously, you know. But I knew it was him, said Gloria. I knew his writing. Dorothy was off one day because her son was having his tonsils out, so Irene was opening the post and she unfolded one of the notes right at the desk beside me. She was gloating about it, and I had to pretend to find it funny, but not to recognize the handwriting. I confronted Luca about it. He told me not to be so stupid. Of course he hadn't written the notes, but I knew he had. Anyway, I think it was right after the second note. I found out what I'd been terrified about happening had happened. I was pregnant. I hadn't realized that the pill wouldn't work if you'd had a stomach upset, and I'd had a bug a month before. I knew I was cornered, and it was too late. I'd have to marry Luca. The Ricci's would want it, and my grandparents wouldn't want me to be an unwed mother. That's when I admitted it to myself for the first time, said Gloria, looking directly at Strike and Robin. I absolutely hated Luca Ricci. Gloria, said Robin quietly, I'm sorry to interrupt, but could I ask you, when you were sick at Margot's barbecue, you heard about that, did you? Yes, that was when I had the tummy bug. People said one of the kids had spiked the punch, but I don't think so. Nobody else was as ill as I was. Out of the corner of Robin's eye, she saw Strike writing something in his notebook. I went back to Margot to find out for sure whether I was pregnant, said Gloria. I knew I could trust her. I broke down again in her surgery and cried my eyes out when she confirmed it. And then, well, she was just lovely. She held my hand and talked to me for ages. I thought abortion was a sin, said Gloria. That's the way I was raised. She didn't think it was a sin. Not Margot. She talked to me about the life I was likely to have with Luca if I had the baby. We discussed me keeping it alone, but we both knew Luca wouldn't want that, that he'd be in my life forever if I had his kid. It was hard, then, being on your own with a child. I was watching Janice, the nurse, doing it, always juggling her son and the job. I didn't tell Luca, obviously, said Gloria. I knew that if I was going to do anything, I had to do it quickly, before he noticed my body change, but most of all, before the baby could feel it or... Gloria suddenly bowed her head and covered her face with her hands.
"I'm so sorry," said Robin. "It must have been awful for you."
"No, well," said Gloria, straightening up and again pushing back her white hair, her eyes wet.
"Never mind that. I'm only telling you so you understand.
Margot made the appointment for me. She gave the clinic her name and contact details, and she bought us both wigs, because if she was recognized, someone might recognize me by association. And she came with me. It was a Saturday, to this place in Bride Street. I've never forgotten the name of the street, because a bride is exactly what I didn't want to be, and that's why I was there. The clinic had been using Margot's name as the referring doctor, and I think somewhere there were cross wires because they thought Margot Bamborough was the one having the procedure. Margot said, "It doesn't matter, nobody'll ever know, all these records are confidential." And she said, in a way it was convenient, if there was any follow-up needed, they could contact her and arrange it. "She held my hand on the way in, and she was there when I woke up," said Gloria. And now tears leaked from her dark eyes, and she brushed them quickly away. "When I was ready to go home, she took me to the end of my grandparents' street in a taxi. She told me what to do afterwards, how to take care of myself." "I wasn't like Margot," said Gloria, her voice breaking. "I didn't believe it was right, what I did. September the 14th. I don't think that date's come by once since that I haven't remembered and thought about that baby. When I went back to work after a couple of days off, she took me into her office and asked me how I was feeling. And then she said, 'Now, Gloria, you've got to be brave. If you stay with Luca, this will happen again.' She said, 'We need to find you a job away from London and make sure he doesn't know where you've gone.' And she said something that stayed with me always. 'We aren't our mistakes. It's what we do about the mistake that shows who we are.' But I wasn't like Margot," said Gloria again. "I wasn't brave. I couldn't imagine leaving my grandparents. I pretended to agree, but 10 days after the abortion, I was sleeping with Luca again. Not because I wanted to, but because there didn't seem any other choice. And then," said Gloria, "about a month after we'd been to the clinic, it happened. Margot disappeared." A muffled male voice was now heard at Gloria's end of the call. She turned towards the door behind her and said, "Non, c'est toujours en cours." Turning back to her computer, she said, "Pardon, I mean, sorry." "Mrs. Joubert." "Gloria," said Strike, "could we please take you back through the day Margot disappeared?" "The whole day?" Strike nodded. Gloria took a slow inward breath, like somebody about to dive into deep water, then said, "Well, the morning was all normal. Everyone was there except Wilma, the cleaner. She didn't come in on Fridays. I remember two things about the morning. Meeting Janice by the kettle at the back, and her going on about the sequel to The Godfather coming out soon, and me pretending to be excited about it, and actually feeling as though I'd run a mile rather than go and see it. And Irene being quite smug and pleased, because Janice had just been on a date with some man she'd been trying to set Janice up with for ages." "Irene was funny about Janice," said Gloria. "They were supposed to be such great friends, but she was always going on about Janice being a bit of a man-eater, which was funny if you'd known Irene. She used to say that Janice needed to learn to cut her cloth, that she was deluded, waiting for someone like James Caan to show up and sweep her off her feet, because she was a single mother and not that great a catch. Irene thought the best she could hope for was this man from Eddie's work, who sounded a bit simple. Irene was always laughing about him getting things wrong. We were quite busy, as I remember it, all three doctors coming in and out of the waiting room to call for their patients. I can't remember anything unusual about the afternoon, except that Irene left early. She claimed she had a toothache, but I thought it was a fib at the time. She hadn't seemed in pain to me when she was going on about Janice's love life. I knew Margot was meeting her friend later in the pub. She told me, because she had a doughnut in cling film in the fridge, and she asked me to bring it through to her right before she saw her last patient, to keep her going. She loved sugar. She was always in the biscuit tin at 5 o'clock. She had one of those metabolisms, never put on weight, full of nervous energy. I remember the doughnut because when I took it into her, I said, "Why didn't you just eat those chocolates?" She had a box she'd taken out of the bin. I think it was the day before. I mean, they were still in their cellophane when she took them out of the bin. It wasn't unhygienic. Someone had sent them to her. "Someone," repeated Strike. "Well, we all thought it was that patient the police were so interested in. Steve Douthwaite," said Gloria. "Dorothy thought that anyway."
"Wasn't there a message attached?"
"There was a card saying, 'Thank you,'" said Gloria. "And Dorothy might have made the assumption it was Steve Douthwaite, because we all thought he was turning up a lot. I don't think the card was signed, though." So Margot threw the box in the bin, and then took it out again afterwards. "Yes, because I laughed at her about it," said Gloria. "I said, 'I knew you couldn't resist.' And she laughed too. And next day, when I said, 'Why don't you eat them?' she said, 'I have. I finished them.'"
"But she still had the box there?"
"Yes, on the shelf with her books. I went back to the front desk. Dr. Brenner's patient left, but Brenner didn't, because he was writing up the notes."
"Could I ask you whether you knew about Dr. Brenner's barbiturate addiction?" asked Strike.
"His what?" said Gloria.
"Nobody ever told you about that?"
"No," she said, looking surprised. "I had no idea."
"You never heard that Janice had found an amytal capsule in the bottom of a cup of tea?"
"No." "Oh, is that why Margot started making her own tea? She told me Irene made it too milky."
"Let's go back to the order in which everyone left."
"Okay, so, Dr. Gupta's patient was next, and Dr. Gupta left immediately afterwards. He had some family dinner he needed to attend, so off he went. And then, just when I was thinking we were done for the day, in walked that girl, Theo."
"Tell us about Theo," said Strike.
"Long black hair, dark-skinned. She looked Romanian or Turkish. Ornate earrings, you know. Gypsyish. I actually thought she looked like a gypsy. I'd never seen her before, so I knew she wasn't registered with us. She looked as though she was in a lot of pain with her stomach. She came up to the desk and asked to see a doctor urgently. I asked her name, and she said Theo, something or other. I didn't ask her again because she was obviously suffering, so I told her to wait and went to see whether a doctor was free. Margot's door was still closed, so I asked Dr. Brenner. He didn't want to see her. He was always like that, always difficult. I never liked him. Then Margot's door opened, and the mother and child who'd been seeing her left, and she said she'd see the girl who was waiting."
"And Theo was definitely a girl?" asked Strike.
"Without any doubt at all," said Gloria firmly. "She was broad-shouldered. I noticed that when she came to the desk. But she was definitely a woman. Maybe it was the shoulders that made Dr. Brenner say afterwards she looked like a man, but honestly, I was thinking about him last night, knowing I was going to be talking to you. Brenner was probably the biggest misogynist I ever met. He'd denigrate women for not looking feminine or talking like a lady. But he also despised Irene, who was giggly and blonde and very feminine, you know. I suppose what he wanted was for us all to be like Dorothy, subordinate and respectful, high collars, low hemlines. Dorothy was like a really humourless nun." Robin thought of Betty Fuller lying on a bed, pretending to be comatose, while Brenner poured filthy words into her ear. Women patients really didn't like Brenner. We were always having them asking to switch to Margot, but we had to turn most of them down because her list was so full. But Brenner was coming up for retirement, and we were hoping we'd get someone better when he went. So, yes, he left, and Theo went in to see Margot. I kept checking the time because I was supposed to be meeting Luca, and if I kept him waiting, there was always trouble. But Theo's appointment just went on and on. At 6:15, Theo finally came back out of the surgery and left.
Margot came through just a couple of minutes later. She seemed absolutely exhausted. It had been a full day. She said, "I'm going to write her notes up tomorrow. I've got to go. Una's waiting. Lock up with a spare key." "I didn't really answer," said Gloria, "because I was so worried about Luca getting angry with me. So I never said goodbye or have a good evening to this woman who saved my life. Because she did, you know. I never said it to her, but she did." A tear trickled down her face. Gloria paused to wipe it away, then said, "I remember as she put her umbrella up, she slipped, turned over on her heel. It was raining, the pavement was wet. Then she straightened up and walked out of sight. I started dashing around, turning off lights, locking the records up in the filing cabinets. Then I made sure the back door was locked, which it was. The police asked me about that. I closed and locked the front door and ran straight up passing Alley, which was right beside the surgery, to meet Luca in St. John Street. And that was the last time I ever saw Margot." Gloria reached again for her almost empty wine glass and drained it. "Did you have any idea what might have happened to her?" asked Strike. "Of course," said Gloria quietly. "I was terrified Luca had got someone to hurt her, or kidnap her. She'd become a bugbear to him. Every time I stood up for myself, he'd say horrible things about Margot influencing me. He was convinced she was trying to persuade me to leave him, which of course she was. My greatest fear was that he'd somehow find out what she'd helped me do, you know, in Bride Street. I knew he couldn't have abducted her personally, because I met him on St. John Street, not 5 minutes after she left the surgery, and I know it can't have been his father, because his brother Marco was in hospital at the time, and the parents were with him round the clock. But Luca had friends and cousins. I couldn't tell the police. Luca had stopped pretending he was joking when he threatened my grandparents. I asked him whether he was behind it, though. The anxiety was too much. I had to ask. He got really angry, called me names, dumb bitch, things like that. He said, of course he hadn't. But he told me stories about his father making people disappear. So I just didn't know." "Did you ever have reason to suppose he knew?" Robin hesitated. "What happened in Bride Street?" "I'm absolutely positive he never knew," said Gloria. "Margot was too good for him. The Whigs and using her name and giving me a plausible story for why I couldn't have sex with him for a while. She's the reason I got away with it. No, I don't believe he ever knew. So in my best moments, I thought he didn't really have a strong enough reason." The door behind Gloria opened, and in walked a handsome, aquiline-nosed, grey-haired man in a striped shirt and jeans, carrying a bottle of red wine. A large German shepherd dog followed him into the room, its tail wagging. "Je m'excuse," he said, smiling at Strike and Robin on screen. "I am sorry for... Comment dit-on interrompre?" he asked his wife. "Interrupt," she said. "Oui. I am sorry for interrupt." He refilled his wife's glass, handed it back to her, patted her on the shoulder, then walked out again, calling the dog. "Viens, Obélix." When both man and dog had disappeared, Gloria said with a little laugh, "That was Hugo." "How long did you stay at the St. John's practice after Margot disappeared?" asked Strike, although he knew the answer. 6-7 months, I think," said Gloria. "Long enough to see the new policeman take over. We were all pleased, because the first, Talbot, wasn't it, was quite strange. He bullied the life out of Wilma and Janice. I think that's what made Wilma ill, actually. She had quite enough on her plate without the police hounding her." "You don't think she drank, then?" asked Robin. "Drank? That was all Dorothy's malice," said Gloria, shaking her head. "Dorothy was trying to pin the thefts on Wilma. Have you heard about that?" Strike and Robin nodded. "When she couldn't prove that Wilma was taking the money out of people's bags, she put it about that she was drinking, and the poor woman resigned. She was probably glad to leave, but it was still losing a salary, wasn't it?" "I wanted to leave myself," said Gloria, "but I was paralyzed. I had this really strange feeling that If I just stayed there, the world would right itself. Margot would come back. It was only after she disappeared that I realized what she'd been to me. Anyway, sighed Gloria, one night, months after she disappeared, Luca was really violent to me. I'd smiled at a man who opened a door for me as I left the pub with Luca. That's what sparked it. He beat me like he'd never beaten me before, at his place. He had this little flat. I remember saying, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have smiled at him. And all the time I was saying it, I could see, in here, Gloria tapped her head, Margot watching me. And even while I was begging Luca to stop, and agreeing I'd behave like a little slut, and I shouldn't ever smile at strange men, I was thinking, I'm going, Margot. I'm going where he'll never find me. Because it had clicked in my head at last. She told me I needed to be brave. It was no good waiting for anyone else to save me. I had to save me. After he'd calmed down, he let me go home to my grandparents' house, but he wanted to see me again later. It was always like that after he'd been really violent. He wanted extra contact. He hadn't beaten me in the face. He never did. He never lost control like that. So I went back to my grandparents and acted as though everything was fine. Went out to meet Luca that night, and he took me out for dinner. And that was the night he proposed, with a ring and everything. And I said yes, said Gloria, with a strange smile and a shrug. I put that ring on, and I looked down at it, and I didn't even have to act happy, because I genuinely was. I thought, that'll buy some of my plane ticket. Mind you, I'd never flown before in my life. The idea of it scared me. But all the time I could see Margot in my head. You've got to be brave, Gloria. I had to tell my grandparents I was engaged. I couldn't tell them what I was really planning, because I was scared they wouldn't be able to act, or that they'd try and confront Luca, or worse, go to the police. Anyway, Luca came round to the house to meet them properly, pretending to be a nice guy, and it was awful, and I had to act as though I was thrilled about all of it. Every single day after that, I bought all the newspapers and circled all of the jobs abroad that I might have a chance of getting. I had to do all of it in secret. Typed up a CV at work and got a bus to the West End to post all the applications, because I was scared someone who knew Luca would see me putting lots of envelopes in the post. After a few weeks, I got an interview with a French woman who was looking for an English home help to teach her kids English. What really got me the job was being able to type. She ran her own business from home, so I could do a bit of admin for her while the kids were at nursery. The job came with room and board, and my employer would buy my plane ticket, so I didn't have to sell Luca's ring and pretend I'd lost it. You know, the day I went into St. John's and told them I was resigning, a funny thing happened. Nobody had mentioned Margot for weeks. Immediately after she disappeared, it was all any of us could talk about. But then it became taboo somehow. We had a new locum doctor in her room. I can't remember his name. A new cleaner, too. But this day, Dorothy arrived quite flustered, and she never showed any emotion, usually. This local... what's the word? Said Gloria, clicking her fingers, for the first time lost in her native language. We'd say, dangue. Oh, you know, a crazy man, a loon. Harmless, but strange. Big, long beard, dirty. You used to see him wandering up and down Clerkenwell Road with his son. Anyway, he'd sort of accosted Dorothy in the middle of the street and told her he killed Margot Bamborough. It had shaken Dorothy up, but in an odd way. Please don't think this is awful. I hoped it was true, because although I'd have given anything to know Margot was alive, I was sure she was dead. She wasn't the type to run away, and my worst nightmare was that Luca was responsible, because that meant it was all my fault. Robin shook her head, but Gloria ignored her. I only told my grandparents the truth the night before I was due to leave for France. I hadn't let them spend any money on the wedding that wasn't going to happen, but even so, it was a huge shock to them.
I sat them down and told them everything, except for the termination. Of course, they were appalled. At first, they didn't want me to leave. They wanted me to go to the police. I had to explain why that was a terrible idea, tell them about the threats Luca had made, and all of that. But they were so glad I wasn't marrying him, they accepted it in the end. I told them it would all die down, and I'd be back soon, even though I wasn't sure that was true, or if it would be possible. My grandfather took me to the airport early next day. We'd worked out a story for when Luca came asking where I was. They were to say I'd been having doubts because he'd been violent, and that I'd gone over to Italy to stay with some of Dad's relatives, to think things over. We even concocted a fake address to give him. I don't know whether he ever wrote to it. "And that's everything," said Gloria, sitting back in the desk chair. I stayed with my first employer for 7 years, and ended up with a junior position in her firm. I didn't visit London again until I heard Luca was safely married. She took another sip of wine from the glass her husband had refilled. His first wife drank herself to death at the age of 39. He used to beat her badly. I found all that out later. "And I've never told another lie about myself," said Gloria, raising her chin. "Never exaggerated, never pretended. Only ever told the absolute truth. Except on one point. Until tonight, the only person who knew about the abortion was Hugo. But now you two know too. Even if you find out Luca was behind what happened to Margot, and I have to have that on my conscience forever, I owe her the truth. That woman saved me, and I've never, ever forgotten her. She was one of the bravest, kindest people I've ever known."
Chapter 67. There, by the uncertain glimmers of starry night, and by the twinkling of their sacred fire, he mote perceive a little dawning sight. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. They thanked Gloria for her time and her honesty. Having bidden her goodbye, Strike and Robin sat at the partners' desk, each of them sunk in thought, until Strike offered Robin one of the pots of dehydrated noodles he kept for snacks in the office. She declined, instead taking a bag of mixed nuts unenthusiastically out of her bag and opening it. Once Strike had added boiling water to the plastic pot, he returned to the desk, stirring the noodles with a fork. "It's the efficiency," he said, sitting down again. "That's what's bugging me. Literally no trace of her anywhere. Somebody was either extraordinarily clever or unprecedentedly lucky. And Creed still fits that picture best, with Luca Ricci a close second. Except it can't have been Luca. He's got an alibi. Gloria. But as she says, he knew people who could take care of making someone disappear. Because what are the odds, if Margot was abducted off the street, that this was a truly one-person job? Even Creed had his unwitting accomplices. The dozy landlady giving him that safe basement, and the dry cleaner letting him have the van that day, and don't," said Robin sharply.
"Don't what?"
"Blame them."
"I'm not blaming them, I'm—"
"Max and I were talking about this," said Robin, "about the way people, women usually, get blamed for not knowing or seeing. But everyone's guilty of that kind of bias. Everyone does it."
"You think," said Strike thickly, through his first mouthful of noodles.
"Yes," said Robin. "We've all got a tendency to generalize from our own past experiences. Look at Violet Cooper. She thought she knew who Creed really was, because she'd met a couple of men who behaved like him in her theatre days.
Men who wouldn't let anyone in their basement flats because they were boiling down skulls."
"You know what I mean, Strike," said Robin, refusing to be amused. "Soft-spoken, apparently gentle, slightly feminine. Creed liked putting on her feather boa, and he pretended to like show tunes, so she thought he was a gay man. But if the only gay man she'd met had been Max, my flatmate—"
"He's gay, is he?"
said Strike, whose memories of Max were indistinct.
"Yes, and he isn't remotely camp and hates musicals.
Come to that, if she'd met a couple of Matt's straight mates down the rugby club who couldn't wait to shove oranges up their T-shirts and prance around,
she might have drawn a different conclusion, mightn't she?
"'Spose so,'
said Strike, chewing noodles and considering this point.
"'And in fairness, most people don't know any serial killers.'
"'Exactly. So even if somebody's got some unusual habits, our direct experience tends to suggest they're just eccentric. Fye had never met a man who fetishized women's clothing or—'
"'Sorry I'm boring you,'
Robin added, because Strike's eyes seemed to have glazed over.
"'No, you aren't,' he muttered.
"'You're actually making me think. I had an idea, you know. I thought I'd spotted some coincidences, and it got me wondering.'
He set down the pot of noodles, reached under the desk, and pulled one of the boxes of police evidence towards him, on top of which lay the pages he'd last been re-examining. He now took these bits of paper out, spread them in front of himself again, and resumed his noodle-eating. "'Are you going to tell me about the coincidences?' said Robin, with a trace of impatience.
"'Hang on a minute,'
said Strike, looking up at her.
"'Why was Theo standing outside the phone box?'
"'What?'
said Robin, confused.
"'I don't think we can doubt now, can we, that Ruby Elliot saw Theo by that phone box near Albemarle Way? Her description and Gloria's tally exactly. So why was Theo standing outside the phone box?'
"'She was waiting for the van to pick her up.'
"'Right. But, not to state the bleeding obvious, the sides of the old red telephone boxes have windows. It was pissing down with rain. Theo didn't have an umbrella. And Ruby said Theo's hair was plastered down. So, why didn't she shelter in the telephone box and keep watch for a lift? Clerkenwell Road's long and straight. She'd have had a perfectly good view from that telephone box and plenty of time to come out and show herself to the van driver. Why,
said Strike for the third time,
was she standing outside the phone box?
Because there was someone in it?
That would seem the obvious explanation. And that phone box at the end of Albemarle Way would give you a view of the top of St. John's Lane.
You think someone was lying in wait for Margot? "'Watching out from that phone box?'
Strike hesitated.
"'Do me a favour and look up Fragile X Syndrome.'
"'Okay. Why?'
said Robin, setting down her almonds and beginning to type.
"'That phone box is at the end of the Athorn Street.'
While Robin brought up the search results, Strike pulled the copy of Irene Hickson's receipt towards him. It had the time 3:10 p.m. on it. Eating noodles, Strike was still looking at the slip of paper when Robin said, reading off her screen, "'First called Martin Bell syndrome. The FMR1 gene on the X chromosome was sequenced in 1991.
Sorry, what exactly do you need?
What specific disabilities does it cause?'
"'Social anxiety,' said Robin, reading again. "'Lack of eye contact, challenges forming relationships, anxiety with unfamiliar situations and people, poor ability to recognise faces you've seen before. But good long-term memory, good imitation, skills and good visual learning. Men are more severely affected than women. Good sense of humour usually can be creative, especially visually.'
She looked around the computer monitor.
"'Why do you want to know all this?'
"'Just thinking.'
"'About Gwilhelm?'
"'Yeah.' said Strike. Well, about the whole family.
He didn't have Fragile X, though, did he?
No, I don't know what Gwilhelm's problem was. Maybe just the Bennies.
He didn't smile as he said the name this time.
Cormoran, what coincidences did you notice?
Instead of answering, Strike pulled a couple of pages of police notes towards him and read through them again. Out of force of habit, Robin reached out for Talbot's notebook and turned to the first page. For a couple of minutes, there was silence in the office, and neither partner noticed any of the noises that were as familiar to them as their own breathing. The traffic rolling down Charing Cross Road, occasional shouts, and snatches of music from Denmark Street below. The very first page of Bill Talbot's notebook began with untidy jottings of what Robin knew to be genuine evidence and observations. It was the most coherent part of the notes, but the first pentagrams appeared at the very bottom of the page, as did the first astrological observation.
Theo? Question mark. Male? Question mark.
white van speeding Aylesbury Street away from Clerkenwell Green, two women struggling by phone boxes, smaller in rain hat, taller in raincoat, seems unsteady on feet, then van speeding away from Clerkenwell Green. Jupiter is currently retrograde in Pisces, meaning planet of objective truth, in sign of illusion and fantasy. Robin reread this final paragraph twice, frowning slightly. Then she set aside her bag of almonds to delve in the nearest box of police evidence. It took her 5 minutes to find the original police record of Ruby Elliott's statement, and while she searched, Strike remained deeply immersed in his own portion of the notes. "I saw them beside a telephone box, two women sort of struggling together. The tall one in the raincoat was leaning on the short one, who was in a plastic rain hood. They both looked like women to me, but I didn't see their faces. It looked to me like one was trying to make the other walk quicker." Pulse now quickened, Robin set aside this piece of paper, got back onto her knees, and began to search for the record of Ruby's statement to Lawson, which took her another 5 minutes. "I saw them beside the two telephone boxes in Clerkenwell Green, two women struggling with each other. The tall one in the raincoat was trying to make the little one in the rain hood walk faster."
"Cormoran," said Robin urgently.
Strike looked up.
"The heights are round the wrong way."
"What?"
"In Ruby's very first statement to Talbot," Robin said, "she said, 'I saw them beside a telephone box, two women sort of struggling together. The tall one in the raincoat was leaning on the short one, who was in a plastic rain hood. They both looked like women to me, but I didn't see their faces. It looked to me like one was trying to make the other walk quicker.'"
"Right," said Strike, frowning slightly.
"And that's what Talbot wrote in his horoscope notes, too," said Robin. "But that's not how it should have been if these two women were the Fleurys. Where's that picture?"
"Box one," said Strike, shoving it towards Robin with his real foot. She crouched down beneath the desk and began searching the photocopied papers until she found the sheaf of newspaper clippings Strike had shown her months previously in The Three Kings.
"There," said Robin.
"Look, there." And there was the old picture of the two women who'd come forward to say that they were Ruby's struggling women, the tall, broad, younger woman with her cheery face, and her aged mother, who was tiny and stooped.
"It's the wrong way round," repeated Robin.
"If Fiona Fleury had leaned on her mother, she'd have flattened her." Robin scanned the few lines beneath the picture.
"Cormoran, it doesn't fit. Fiona says she was wearing the rain hat, but Ruby says it was the short woman who had the rain hat on."
"Ruby was vague," said Strike.
But Robin could see his interest sharpening as he reached out for these pieces of paper.
"She could have been confused.
Talbot never thought the Fleurys were the people Ruby saw. And this is why," said Robin. "The heights were reversed. It was the taller woman Ruby saw who was unsteady, not the little one."
"So how come she didn't tell Lawson the Fleurys couldn't be the people she saw?"
"Same reason she never told anybody she'd seen Theo. Because she'd been flustered by Talbot, trying to force her to bend her story to fit his theories. Because she lost confidence in herself and didn't know what she'd really seen. It was raining, she was lost, she was panicked. By the time it got to Lawson, maybe she just wanted to agree she'd seen the Fleurys and be left alone."
"Plausible," admitted Strike.
"How tall was Margot?"
5'9", said Strike.
"And Creed?" said Robin.
5'7".
"Oh, God," said Robin quietly.
There was another minute's silence while Strike sat lost in thought and Robin reread the statements laid out in front of her.
"The phone boxes," said Strike at last. "Those bloody phone boxes."
"What about them?"
"Talbot wanted Ruby to have seen the two struggling women beside the two boxes in Clerkenwell Green, right? So he could tie them to the van that was speeding away up Aylesbury Street, which was supposed to contain Creed."
"Right," said Robin.
"But after the Fleurys came forward, Talbot tried to get Ruby to agree she'd seen the two struggling women beside the first phone box, the one at the end of Albemarle Way."
"But she wouldn't change her story," said Robin, "because she'd seen Theo there."
"Precisely," said Strike. but that doesn't make sense.
I don't. She's driving round in an enormous circle in the rain, right? Looking for this house she can't find, right?
Yes.
Well, just because Ruby saw Theo get into a van by the phone box on one of her circuits doesn't mean she can't have seen two struggling women on a second or third circuit. We know she was hazy about landmarks, unfamiliar with the area, and with no sense of direction. Her daughter was very clear about that. But she had this very retentive visual memory. She's somebody who notices clothes and hairstyles.
Strike looked down at the desk again, and for the second time, picked up Irene Hickson's receipt and examined it. Then, so suddenly that Robin jumped, Strike let the receipt fall and stood up, both hands clasped over the back of his head.
Shit, he said. Shit! Never trust a phone call whose provenance you haven't checked.
What phone call? Said Robin nervously, casting her mind back over any phone call she'd taken over the course of the case.
Fuck's sake, said Strike,
walking out of the room into the outer office, then back again, still clasping the back of his head, apparently needing to pace, just as Robin had needed to walk when she'd found out Strike could interview Creed.
How did I not fucking see it?
Cormoran, what?
Why did Margot keep an empty chocolate box? Said Strike.
I don't know, said Robin, confused.
You know what? Said Strike slowly. I think I do.
Chapter 68. An hyena was that feeds on women's flesh as others feed on grass. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. The high-security mental hospital that is Broadmoor lies slightly over an hour outside London, in the county of Berkshire. The word Broadmoor had long since lost all bucolic associations in the collective mind of the British public, and Strike was no exception to this rule. Far from connoting a wide stretch of grassland or heath, the name spoke to Strike only of violence, heinous crimes, and 200 of the most dangerous men in Britain, whom the tabloids call monsters. Accordingly, and in spite of the fact that Strike knew he was visiting a hospital and not a prison, he took all the common-sense measures he'd have taken for a high-security jail. He wore no tie, ensured that neither he or his car was carrying anything likely to trigger a burdensome search, brought two kinds of photographic ID and a copy of his letter from the Ministry of Justice, set out early, certain, though he'd never been there before, that getting inside the facility would be time-consuming. It was a golden September morning, sunshine pouring down upon the road ahead from between fluffy white clouds, and as Strike drove through Berkshire in his BMW, he listened to the news on the radio, the lead item of which was that Scotland had voted by 55% to 45% to remain in the United Kingdom. He was wondering how Dave Polworth and Sam Barclay were taking the news when his mobile rang.
It's Brian. Brian Tucker, said the hoarse voice. Not interrupting, am I? Want to wish you good luck.
Thanks, Brian, said Strike.
They'd finally met 3 days previously at Strike's office. Tucker had shown Strike the old letter from Creed, described the butterfly pendant taken from the killer's basement, which he believed was his daughter's, shared his theories, and trembled with emotion and nerves at the thought of Strike coming face to face with a man he believed had murdered his eldest daughter.
"I'll let you go. I won't keep you,"
said Tucker.
"You'll ring me when it's over, though."
"I will, of course," said Strike.
It was hard to concentrate on the news now that he'd heard Tucker's anxiety and excitement. Strike turned off the radio and turned his thoughts instead to what lay ahead. Gratifying though it would be to believe that he, Cormoran Strike, might trick or persuade Creed into confessing where all others had failed, Strike wasn't that egotistical. He'd interviewed plenty of suspects in his career. The skill lay in making it easier for a suspect to disclose the truth than to continue lying. Some were worn down by patient questioning, others resistant to all but intense pressure, still others yearned to unburden themselves, and the interrogator's methods had to change accordingly. However,
In talking to Creed, half of Strike's interrogatory arsenal would be out of commission. For one thing, he was there at Creed's pleasure, because the patient had had to give his consent for the interview. For another, it was hard to see how Strike could paint a frightening picture of the consequences of silence when his interviewee was already serving life in Broadmoor. Creed's secrets were the only power he had left, and Strike was well aware that persuading him to relinquish any of them might prove a task beyond any human investigator. Standard appeals to conscience or to the desire to figure as a better person to the self or to others were likewise useless. As Creed's entire life demonstrated, his primary sources of enjoyment were inflicting pain and establishing dominance, and it was doubtful that anything else would persuade him into disclosures. Strike's first glimpse of the infamous hospital was of a fortress on raised ground. It had been built by the Victorians in the middle of woodland and meadows, a red brick edifice with a clock tower, the highest point in the compound. The surrounding walls were 20 feet high, and as Strike drove up to the front gates, he could see the heads of hundreds of Cyclopean security cameras on poles. As the gates opened, Strike experienced an explosion of adrenaline, and for a moment the ghostly black-and-white images of 7 dead women and the anxious face of Brian Tucker seemed to swim before him. He'd sent his car registration number in advance. Once through the first set of double gates, he encountered an inner wire fence as tall as the wall he'd just passed through. A white-shirted, black-trousered man of military bearing unlocked a second set of gates once the first had closed behind the BMW and directed Strike to a parking space. Before leaving his car and wanting to save time going through the security he was about to face, the detective put his phone, keys, belt, cigarettes, lighter, and loose change into the glove compartment and locked it.
"Mr. Strike, is it?"
said the smiling, white-shirted man, whose accent was Welsh and whose profile suggested a boxer.
"Got your ID there?"
Strike showed his driver's license and was led inside, where he encountered a scanner of the airport security type. Good-humoured, inevitable amusement ensued when the scanner announced shrill disapproval of Strike's metal lower leg, and his trousers had to be rolled up to prove he wasn't carrying a weapon. Having been patted down, he was free to join Dr. Ranbir Bijral, who was waiting for him on the other side of the scanners. A slight, bearded psychiatrist, whose open-necked yellow shirt struck a cheerful note against the dull green-grey tiled floors, the white walls, and the unfresh air of all medical institutions, part disinfectant, part fried food, with a trace of incarcerated human. "We've got 20 minutes until Dennis will be ready for you," said Dr. Bijral, leading Strike off along an eerily empty corridor through many sets of turquoise swing doors. "We coordinate patient movements carefully, and it's always a bit of a feat moving him around. We have to make sure he never comes into contact with patients who have a particular dislike for him, you see. He's not popular. We'll wait in my office." Strike was familiar with hospitals, but had never been inside one with so little bustle or shuffle of patients in the corridors. The emptiness was slightly unnerving. They passed many locked doors. A short female nurse in navy scrubs marched past. She smiled at Strike, who smiled back.
"You've got women working here," he said,
slightly surprised.
"Of course," said Dr. Bijral.
Strike had somehow imagined an all-male staff, even though he knew that male prisons had female warders. Dr. Bijral pushed open a door to a small office that had the air of a converted treatment room, with chipped paint on the walls and bars on the windows. "Have a seat," said Dr. Bijral, waving his hand at the chair opposite his desk, and with slightly forced politeness he asked, "Did you have a good journey? Come up from London?"
"Yeah, it was a nice drive," said Strike.
As he sat down behind the desk, Dr. Bijral became businesslike. "All right, so, we're going to give you 45 minutes with Creed."
45 minutes, repeated Strike.
"If Dennis wants to admit to another killing, that should be ample time," said Dr. Bijral. "But may I be honest with you, Mr. Strike?"
"Of course."
If it had been down to Dennis's treatment team, we probably wouldn't have permitted this visit. I know the MOJ feel the Bamberers and the Tuckers ought to be given a last chance to ask Dennis about their relatives, but... Dr. Bijral leaned back in his seat and sighed. He's a classic sociopath, you see. A pure example of the type. He scores very highly on the dark triad. Narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. Devious, sadistic, unrepentant, and extremely egotistical.
Not a fan, then, said Strike. And the doctor permitted himself a perfunctory smile.
The problem, you see, is if he admitted to another murder under your questioning, you'd get the credit. And Dennis can't have that. He can't allow somebody else to come out on top. He had to give his consent to meeting you, of course. And I think he's agreed because it feeds his ego to be questioned, especially by a man who's been in the papers. And I think he'd like to manipulate you into being an advocate for him in some way. He's been lobbying to get out of Broadmoor and back into prison for a long time now.
I thought he was desperate to get in here.
He was, once, said Bijral. High-profile sex offenders are usually under risk of attack in the prison system, as you probably know. You might have seen in the papers, one man nearly took his eye out with a sharpened spoon handle. Dennis wanted to come to Broadmoor when he was first convicted, but there were no grounds to admit him to hospital back then. Psychopathy isn't, in itself, treatable.
What changed?
He was exceptionally difficult to manage in the prison system. He managed to talk a young offender with Asperger's syndrome into killing himself. For that, he was put into solitary confinement. They ended up keeping him there for almost a year. By night, he took to reenacting what had happened in the basement in Liverpool Road, screaming through the night, doing his voice and the women's. Warders couldn't stand hearing it, let alone prisoners. After 11 months in solitary, he became suicidal. First he went on hunger strike. Then he began trying to bite his own wrists open and smashing his head against the wall. He was assessed, judged psychotic, and transferred here. Once we'd had him a couple of months, he claimed he'd been faking his mental illness, which is pure Dennis. Nobody else can be cleverer than he is. But actually, his mental health was very poor when he came to us, and it took many months of medication and therapy to stop him self-harming and trying to kill himself.
And now he wants to leave.
Once he was well enough to fully appreciate the difference between jail and hospital, I think it's fair to say he was disappointed. He had more freedom in Belmarsh. He did a lot of writing and drawing before he got ill. I read the autobiography he'd been working on when he was admitted. It was useful in assessing him. He writes very well for a man who had hardly any education, but... Dr. Bijral laced his fingers together, and Strike was reminded of another doctor who talked of teamwork while eating fig rolls. You see, persuading patients to discuss their crimes is usually an important part of the therapeutic process. You're trying to find a pathway to accountability and remorse, but Dennis feels no remorse. He's still aroused by the thought of what he did to those women, and he enjoys talking and writing about it. He used to draw episodes from the basement as well, essentially producing his own hardcore pornography. So when he came here, we confiscated all writing and drawing materials. Dennis blames us for his deteriorating mental facilities, although in fact, for a 77-year-old man, he's remarkably sharp. Every patient is different, and we manage Dennis on a strict reward and penalty system. His chosen rewards are unusual. He enjoys chess. He taught himself in Belmarsh, so sometimes I'll give him a game. He likes crosswords and logic puzzles, too. We allow him access to those when he's behaving himself. But you mustn't think he's typical of our patients, added Dr. Bijral earnestly. The vast majority of mentally ill people pose absolutely no risk of violence, as I'm sure you know. And people do leave Broadmoor. They do get better. People's behaviour can change if they're motivated, if they're given the right help. Our aim is always recovery. One can hate the crime, but feel compassion for the perpetrator. Many of the men in here had appallingly abusive childhoods. Dennis's childhood was pure hell, though, of course, other people have upbringings as bad and never do what Dennis did. In fact, one of our former patients... There was a knock on the door, and a cheery blonde poked her head inside.
"That's Dennis ready in the room, Rambier," she said, and withdrew.
"Shall we?" said Dr. Bijral, getting to his feet. "I'll be sitting in on the interview, and so will Dennis's primary nurse." The woman who'd announced Dennis's arrival in the meeting room walked with Strike and the psychiatrist down another couple of corridors. Now there were doors that had to be unlocked and relocked at every passage. Through the third set of locked doors, Strike saw an obese man shuffling along in Nike tracksuit bottoms, flanked by a pair of nurses, each of whom held one of the patient's stiff arms behind his back. The patient gave Strike a glazed look as the trio passed in silence. Finally, Strike's party reached a deserted open-plan area with armchairs and a switched-off TV. Strike had assumed the blonde woman was Creed's nurse, but he was wrong. A burly man with tattoos down both arms and a prominent square jaw was introduced as Marvin, Dennis's lead nurse, and the blonde woman smiled at Strike, wished him luck, and walked away.
"Well, shall we?" said Dr. Bijral, and Marvin opened the door onto a Spartan meeting room with a single window and a whiteboard on the wall. The only occupant, a small, obese, bespectacled man, wore jeans and a black sweatshirt. He had a triple chin, and his belly kept him a foot and a half away from the white formica-top table at which he was sitting. Transplanted to a bus stop, Dennis Creed would have been just another old man, a little unkempt, his light grey hair in need of a trim. He'd pressed hot irons to the bare breasts of Secretary Jackie Eilert. He'd pulled out all of hairdresser Susan Mayer's finger and toenails. He'd dug the eyeballs out of estate agent Noreen Sturrock's face while she was still alive and manacled to a radiator.
"Dennis, this is Cormoran Strike," said Dr. Bijral, as he sat down in a chair against the wall. Marvin stood, tattooed arms folded, beside him.
"Hello, Dennis," said Strike, sitting down opposite him.
"Hello, Cormoran," said Creed, in a flat voice which retained its working-class East London accent. The sunlight fell like a gleaming pane across the table between them, highlighting the smears on the lenses of Creed's wire-rimmed glasses and the dust motes in the air. Behind the dirt, Strike saw irises of such pale grey that they faded into the sclera, so that the enormous pupils seemed surrounded by whiteness. Close to, Strike could see the jagged scar which ran from temple to nose, dragging at his left lower eyelid, a relic of the attack that had almost taken half Creed's sight. The plump, pale hands on the table were slightly shaking, and the slack mouth trembled, side effects, Strike guessed, of Creed's medication.
"Who are you working for?" Creed asked.
"Spet you'll be able to work that out from my questions," said Strike.
"Why not say, then?" asked Creed.
And when Strike didn't answer, he said, "Sign of narcissism. Withholding information to make yourself feel powerful, you know."
Strike smiled.
"It's not a question of trying to feel powerful. I'm simply familiar with the King's Gambit."
Creed pushed his wire-rimmed glasses back up his nose.
"Told you I play chess, did they?"
"Yeah."
"Do you play?"
"Badly."
"So, how does the King's Gambit apply to this situation?"
"Your opening move appears to open an easy route to your king. You're offering to jump straight into discussing the missing woman I'm investigating."
"But you think that's a ploy?"
"Maybe."
There was a short pause, then Creed said,
"I'll tell you who I think sent you then, shall I?"
"Go on."
"Margot Bamborough's daughter," said Dennis Creed, watching carefully for Strike's reaction. "The husband gave up on her long since, but her daughter'll be 40-odd now and she'll be well healed. Whoever hired you's got money. You won't come cheap. I've read all about you in the paper."
"The second possibility," said Creed, when Strike didn't respond, "is old Brian Tucker. He pops up every few years, making a spectacle of himself. Brian's skint, though. Or did he put out the begging bowl on the internet? Get on the computer and whine out some hard luck story, so mugs send in cash. But I think if he'd done that, it would have been in the papers.
Do you get online much? Asked Strike.
We're not allowed in here, said Creed.
Why are you wasting time? We've only got 45 minutes.
Ask a question.
That was a question, what I just asked you.
Why won't you tell me which so-called victim you're interested in?
So-called victim?
Arbitrary labels, said Creed. Victim, patient. This one deserves pity. This one gets caged. Maybe those women are killed with a real patience, and I'm the true victim.
Novel point of view, said Strike.
Yeah, well, does people good to hear novel points of view, said Creed, pushing his glasses up his nose again. Wake them up if they're capable of it.
What would you say you were curing those women of?
The infection of life? Diagnosis, life, terminal. Pity not the fallen. I never knew them. I am not for them. I console not. I hate the consoled and the consoler.
He'd slit open the corners of schoolgirl Geraldine Christie's mouth and photographed her crying and screaming before, as he told her parents from the dock, slitting her throat because she was making so much noise.
I am unique and conqueror. I am not of the slaves that perish.
No, said that. Alistair Crowley, said Strike.
Unusual reading matter, said Creed, for a decorated soldier in the British Army.
Oh, we're all Satanists on the sly, said Strike.
You think you're joking, said Creed, whose expression had become intense. But you kill, and you get given a medal and called a hero. I kill and get called evil and locked up forever. Arbitrary categories.
No watch just down the road from here.
Sandhurst, said Strike.
Sandhurst, repeated Creed, as though Strike hadn't spoken.
Institutions for killers side by side, one to make 'em, one to break 'em.
Explain to me why it's more moral to murder little brown children on Tony Blair's say-so than to do what I did.
I'm made the way I am.
Brain scans will show you. They've studied people like me. It's how we're wired. Why is it more evil to kill because you've got to, because it's your nature, than to blow up poor brown people because we want oil? Properly looked at, I'm the innocent. But I get fattened up and drugged like a captive pig, and you get a state pension.
Interesting argument, said Strike. So you had no control over what you did?
Control, scoffed Creed, shaking his head. That shows how far removed.
I can't explain it in terms someone like you would understand. You have your way, I have my ways. As for the right way, the correct way, and the only way, it does not exist.
Know who said that?
Sounds like Nietzsche, said Strike.
Nietzsche, said Creed, talking over him.
Obviously, yes. I read a lot in Belmarsh. Back before I got stuffed full of so many drugs, I couldn't concentrate from one end of the sentence to another.
I've got diabetes now. Did you know that?
Creed continued.
Yeah, hospital-acquired diabetes. They took a thin, fit man and piled the weight on me with these drugs I don't need and the pig swill we're forced to eat. 800 so-called healers leeching a living off us. They need us ill because we're their livelihoods. Morlocks. Understand that word?
Fictional underbeings, said Strike.
In the time, obviously, yes, said Creed again, who seemed irritated that Strike understood his references.
H.G. Wells. Primitive beings preying on the highly evolved species who don't realize they're being farmed to eat.
Except I realize it. I know what's going on.
"See yourself as one of the Eloi, do you?" asked Strike. "Interesting thing about the Eloi," said Creed, "is their total lack of conscience. The higher race is intellectual, refined, with no so-called remorse. I was exploring all this in my book, the book I was writing before they took it off me. Wells' thing was only a superficial allegory, but he was groping towards a truth. What I was writing, part autobiography, part scientific treatise, but it was taken away from me. They've confiscated my manuscript. It could be an invaluable resource, but no. Because it's mine, it's got to be destroyed. I've got an IQ of 140, but they want my brain flabby like my body."
"You seem pretty alert to me. What drugs have they got you on?"
"I shouldn't be on any drugs at all. I should be in assertive rehab, but they won't let me out of high dependency. They let the little schizophrenics loose in the workshops with knives over there, and I can't have a pencil. When I came here, I thought I'd meet intelligent people. Any child who can memorise a 7x table could be a doctor. It's all rote learning and dogma. The patient's supposed to be a partner in this therapeutic process, and I say I'm well enough to go back to prison."
"Certainly seems sane to me," said Strike.
"Thank you," said Creed, who'd become flushed. "Thank you. You're an intelligent man, it appears. I thought you would be. That's why I agreed to this."
"But you're still on medication."
"I know all about their drugs, and they're giving me too much. I could prescribe better for myself than they know how to, here."
"How do you know about that stuff?" asked Strike.
"Obvious. Easy," said Creed, with a grandiose gesture. "I used myself as a guinea pig. Developed my own series of standardized tests. How well I could walk and talk on 20 milligrams, 30 milligrams. Made notes on disorientation, drowsiness, differences in side effects."
"What kinds of drugs were these?" asked Strike.
"Amobarbital, pentobarbital, phenobarbital," rattled off Creed. "The names of barbiturates of the early 70s, mostly replaced now by other drugs."
"Easy to buy on the street?"
"I only bought off the street occasionally. I had other channels that were never widely known."
And Creed launched into a meandering speech that couldn't properly be called a story, because the narrative was disjointed and full of mysterious hints and oblique allusions. But the gist seemed to be that Creed had been associating with many unnamed but powerful people in the 60s and 70s, and that a steady supply of prescription drugs had been an incidental perk, either of working for gangsters or spying on them for the authorities. He hinted at having been recruited by the security services, spoke of flights to America there was no evidence he'd ever taken, of barbiturate-addicted politicians and celebrities, and the dangerous desire of humans from all walks of life to dope themselves, to cope with the cruel realities of the world, a tendency and temptation which Dennis Creed deplored and had always resisted. Strike surmised that these fake reminiscences were designed to feed Creed's overweening craving for status. No doubt his decades in high-security prisons and mental hospitals had taught him that rape and torture were considered almost as contemptible there as they'd been on the outside. He might continue to derive sexual pleasure from reliving his crimes, but in others they elicited only contempt. Without a fantasy career in which he was part spy, part gangster, a man with 140 IQ was merely a dry-cleaning delivery man, a sexual deviant buying handfuls of downers from street dealers who'd exploited, then betrayed him.
"See all that security all around me at the trial? There were other forces at play. That's all I'll say."
There'd been a solid cordon of police around Creed on his way in and out of court because the crowd had wanted to tear him apart. The details of his torture chamber had leaked. Police had found the hot irons and the pliers, the ball gags and the whips, the photographs Creed had taken of his victims, alive and dead, and the decomposing head and hands of Andrea Hooton sitting in his bathroom sink. But the image of himself Creed now presented Strike
turned murder into something incidental to a much more prestigious criminal life, a hobby that for some reason the public continued to harp on when there was so much more to tell and admire.
Because they like salivating over dirty little things that excite them, as an outlet for their own unacceptable urges, said Creed. I could have been a doctor. Probably should have been, actually.
He'd poured cooking oil over dinner lady Vera Kenny's head, then set her hair on fire and photographed her while it burned, a ball gag in her mouth. He'd cut out unemployed Gail Reitman's tongue. He'd murdered hairdresser Susan Mayer by stamping repeatedly on her head.
"Never killed anyone by overdose, did you?" said Strike.
"It takes far more skill to disorientate them but keep them on their feet. Any fool can shove an overdose down someone's throat. The other takes knowledge and experience. That's how I know they're using too much on me in here, because I understand side effects."
"What were you giving the women in the basement?"
"I never drugged a woman, once I had her at home. Once she was inside, I had other ways of keeping her quiet."
Andrea Hooton's mouth had been sewn shut by Creed while she was still alive. The traces of thread had still been present on the rotting head. The psychiatrist glanced at his watch.
"What if a woman was already drunk?" asked Strike. "Gail Reitman. You picked her up in a bar, right? Wasn't there a danger of overdose if you drugged her on top of the drink?"
"Intelligent question," said Creed,
drinking Strike in with his enormous pupils.
"I can usually tell what a woman's had to the exact unit. Gail was on her own, sulking. Some man had stood her up."
Creed was giving nothing away. These weren't secrets. He'd admitted to it all already in the dock, where he'd enjoyed relaying the facts, watching the reaction of the victim's relatives. The photographs hidden under the floorboards of Gail and Andrea, Susan and Vera, Noreen, Jackie and Geraldine, bound, burned and stabbed, alive and maimed, their mutilated and sometimes headless corpses posed in pornographic attitudes, had damned him before he opened his mouth. But he'd insisted on a full trial, pleading guilty by reason of insanity.
"In a wig, bit of lipstick. They think you're harmless, odd. Maybe queer. Talk to her for a minute or two, little dark corner. You act concerned. Bit of Nembutal in her drink. Tiny amount, tiny," said Creed,
holding his trembling fingers millimetres apart.
"Nembutal and alcohol, potentially dangerous if you don't know what you're doing."
"But I did, obviously."
"So I say, well, I gotta go now, sweetheart. You be careful. Be careful." It always worked.
Creed affected squeaky tones to imitate Gail.
"Oh, don't go. Have a drink."
"No, darling, I need my beauty sleep." "That's when you prove you're not a threat. You make as if you want to leave, or actually walk away. Then, when they call you back, or run into you 10 minutes later, when they're starting to feel like shit, they're relieved. Because you're the nice man who's safe. It was all in my book, the different ways I got 'em. Instructive for women who want to keep out of trouble, you'd think, to read how a highly efficient killer works. But the authorities won't let it be published, which makes you question, are they happy for slags to be picked off on the streets? Maybe they are. Why are there people like me at all, Cormoran? Why's evolution let it happen? Because humans are so highly developed, we can only thin ourselves out with intraspecies predators. Pick off the weak, the morally depraved. It's a good thing that degenerate drunk women don't breed. That's just a fact. It's a fact," said Dennis Creed. "I'd wind down my window. Want a lift, love? Swaying all over the place. Glad to see me."